Given Archie-Anions and defects in conformal field theory, I'm not going to be talking about our work with the multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz. That's something that I'm sure we'll have plenty of time to talk about on other occasions. So this is about what I'm presenting today are some recent results that and it's what we've been doing at the University of Queensland, and yeah, okay. I guess I'll go on to the introduction. So, like the title of the talk says, what we've been looking at is systems of Fibonacci anions. What we're looking at is we've been taking a system of type of anion known as a Fibonacci anion, and we've been looking at the collective behavior of these anions on a one-dimensional lattice. And it turns out that this can be related, the behavior of these anions on the one-dimensional lattice can be related to certain conformal field theories. And to understand how these anions behave, you also have to involve defects in the conformal field theory. But first, I'm going to introduce what all this is about. So I'm going to briefly introduce the notion of an anion. Now, anions are particles in two-dimensional systems, which obey exchange statistics that are not purely fermionic and that are neither pure fermionic nor purely bosonic. So anything that is not a fermion or not a boson is known as an anion. There are no fundamental particles that behave in this way, but there are systems in which quasi-particle excitations do behave in this manner. For example, some of the fractional quantum Hall states are believed to be described by anion models. And the reason that we're interested in anions, well, first of all, they're an exotic phase of matter, so they're interesting in their own right as something to study because of that, but also a subset of some particular anion models are suitable for use as a system for performing universal quantum computation. And so what this means is if we can realize a physical system containing anions of these particular types, and we can develop a technology for manipulating them, just simply moving them around in the system and reading out certain simple properties, then we would have a quantum computer. And what's more, it's a property of these systems that it would be particularly robust against decoherence. And so that's why there's currently a lot of interest in the behavior, in anions in general, in their behavior, and in physical realizations of anionic systems. But to get back to the matchless statistics, which is an important thing which is one of the important properties of these anions, and distinguishes them quite clearly from bosons and fermions. I'm going to start off with two particles here, these two red dots. We're going to say they're bosons to start with, and we've got a wave function psi, which collectively describes these two particles, and we can express it in some arbitrary basis I. The details of that basis are unimportant. What happens when we exchange the particles? Because they're bosons, it has no effect at all on the wave function psi. Now, if we were to replace those bosons with fermions, and we were going to exchange the particles, then we would pick up a minus sign on the wave function. Now, if we were to take a system where we had two anions and we were to exchange them, then we'd find that the transformation properties can be a lot more complicated. Now, in this expression here, what we have is we've acted on our original state with some unitary transformation, and if the matrix M in that unitary transformation is diagonal, then we have a system that's then we have a system where Anions in a distinct charge state will just pick up a phase, and we call this a system of abelian anions. But when n is, that if we allow all possible, if we allow a more general type of transformation matrix n, then it's a system called, then this will be a system of non-abelian anions, and particle exchange can perform transformations on a state more complicated than just multiplying by a phase. Now, we're also going to be relating these anion models to conformal field theories, and because we're dealing with an anion model on a lattice, on a one-dimensional lattice, then we're also going to be needing to talk about a representation of a conformal field theory on a lattice, and I'll describe shortly how we actually, what this actually looks like when we have a conformal field theory on a lattice, and also what we mean when we talk about the defect in the conformal field theory. So we'll start with, I'm going to go into a bit more detail on the anions. I'm going to take this from a very tactical approach. I'm just going to tell you how we describe a system of anions and how we describe manipulations that we can perform on that system. So I'm just going to begin by specifying the properties that we need to actually state to describe this model. So to describe an anion model, we have to have a list of charges. We can think of these as particle types within the system. And for the Fibonacci anion model, we have the vacuum, which is one. So we have the charge one, which represents the vacuum state, and we have the charge tau, which represents the presence of a Fibonacci anion. The notation is just conventional. And we need now to explain how we can combine charges, and we do that by means of a set of fusion rules. And you'll see that for the Fibonacci anions, fusion with the vacuum always returns the charge that you're fusing with the vacuum, so the expected behavior. But if you fuse two Fibonacci anions together, then you have two possible outcomes for that fusion. They could either fuse to the vacuum state, or they could fuse to give you another Fibonacci anion. Because we have this situation where the fusion rules give us multiple possible outcomes for two Fibonacci anions fusing together, this corresponds to a system of non-abelian anions. The Fibonacci anions are also the simplest anionic system which is suitable for universal quantum computation. But we haven't fully specified our model yet. We need to know how we're going to describe a basis of states for Fibonacci anions. So we're going to take our one-dimensional lattice, and we're going to say that we have an anion with charge tau on every single side of this lattice, but that's not enough to specify the state. To describe a basis of states, the way that we describe a basis of states is we also supply a fusion tree. That's this diagram here. What this corresponds to is it's a description of a sequence of fusing the anions in a particular sequence and specifying the outcome of the fusion processes. Now, when I talk about fusion, this could refer to actually taking two anions and physically bringing them together and performing some sort of operation that combines them, but it's also enough to just talk about measuring the total charge within an area and where that area contains two anions. So when I talk about measuring the total charge or about fusing two anions, this isn't necessarily a destructive process. Now, what this fusion tree means, what this fusion tree actually means, we start with the vacuum state, and we fuse initially with the anion on the first site, and from our fusion rules, we know this gives us a total charge of tau. Now we fuse this charge with the anion on the second site, and this gives us a total charge which we'll label x1. It could be 1 or tau. And then we can fuse this with the anion on site 3 to get another charge, x2, and so forth. And we're going to require that our state overall is that our total charge is the vacuum charge,
This corresponds to requiring that we've started, this corresponds to saying that we could have started with the vacuum, and then we've created this system of anions out of the vacuum. It is possible to work with states that have an overall charge as well. This would tend to imply that if we had started from the vacuum and created a system of anions, then we've taken some subsystem with total charge tau and we've removed it a large distance, and we're not going to involve it in our interactions. But in this case, we're going to be interested in systems with a total charge of one. And so our basis of states consists of, we specify a fusion tree, and we have some variables x1, x2, and x3. And to specify a basis of states on this chain of anions, it suffices to take all possible values of x1, x2, and x3 consistent with the fusion rules. And so the resulting diagrams with different values substituted in for x1, x2, and x3 give us a basis. Something that might be a useful comparison is if you're working with, say, a system with SU2 symmetry, and you specify that you have a particle with spin 1/2 on each side of your lattice, then again, this isn't enough to totally constrain the state of the system. And you'd need to specify how these particles fuse if you require them all to fuse to the singlet state. You have to specify how you actually obtain that singlet state by particle fusion. Now, to continue in specifying our anion model, we've introduced one basis by corresponding to a particular fusion tree, but that choice of fusion tree was actually somewhat arbitrary. We could have chosen any fusion tree on the system of anions, and that would also have given us a basis for the a basis of states. Now, we need some way to transform between these bases, and that's given by this operation here, which is known as an F move. To specify an anion model, you also have to specify this F tensor. It's part of describing, it's part of saying that you're working with Fibonacci anions. You specify the charges, the fusion rules. This F move, which enables you, which can be applied consecutively to transform any basis into any other basis, and it has to satisfy certain consistency conditions, which are known as the Pentagon equations. This is simply, we start in one basis, and by repeatedly applying F moves, we transform to a second basis, and we can do this either by means of this intermediate basis here, or we can go by via two other intermediate bases in our transformation from the basis at the left to the basis at the right. And for consistency, we simply require that the means by which we transform from one basis to another shouldn't depend upon the intermediate bases that we might adopt in the en route. So that's just the consistency condition on our change of basis, which restricts strongly the permitted F moves. Now, the final ingredient of an anion model is a notion of grading. This allows us to either reorder the sites in our fusion tree, and so again gives us the means of changing basis, or it allows us to represent a physical exchange of two anions, taking one on one site and one on another site, and actually performing a physical operation which switches these two anions around. Now you'll notice that in this diagram, one of the lines passes over the other, and that's because when you're working with anions, it's not enough to say that they've exchanged, you have to specify the trajectory which they've taken around one another. And so we define the R move with respect, we define grading, and we specify the R tensor with respect to one particular diagram, which is this. But it's a simple method to also go from there to the diagram where we perform the opposite grading, which is basically a matter of complex conjugation. Now, grading also has to satisfy certain consistency conditions, and these are known as the hexagon equations. And again, it's just a matter of internal consistency of the anion model when going from one diagram to another. So that's the practical introduction to anions to the extent that we're going to be needing in this talk. And so now I'm going to talk a bit about what I mean by conformal field theory on a lattice. So here we have an infinite lattice, and we're going to say that each local site is, for example, each local site might be, say, a spin site which has spin up or spin down on it, So it might have local dimension of 2 or 3 or something, but we're going to work with a spin chain here rather than with anything more complicated. We'll bring the anions into this later. So for now, we have an infinite spin chain or an infinite lattice, and we're going to introduce an operator on that lattice. And so here we've got a local operator. And we're also going to have some sort of coarse graining procedure on the lattice. Now, the exact nature of this coarse graining procedure isn't particularly important, but what we can say about it is that for this example, for the one that I've drawn here, this coarse graining procedure would take 3 sites on the original lattice into 1 site on the coarse grained lattice. Now, there's nothing particularly special about the number 3. We could do it for 2 or 4 or 5. In practice, we tend to use an ansatz for which implementing 3 is particularly easy. We would use a form of the multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz, the mirror. But this is as close as I'm going to actually get to mentioning mirror in this talk. So we have some form of coarse graining process. And once we apply this coarse graining process, we go to the coarse grained lattice, and for certain particular choices of operator on the original lattice, after we've performed the coarse graining process, we can recover the same operator on the coarse grained lattice up to some multiplicative constant. And operators that behave in this manner we call local scaling operators. Now, there's a correspondence between local scaling operators on the lattice and the fields of conformal field theory. However, for any conformal field theory, there's an infinite number of fields, but these can be organized into groups known as conformal towers. There may be an infinite or a finite number of conformal towers, depending on the theory that you're actually working with, but we're going to be concerned with models that have a finite number of conformal towers. And to fully describe the conformal field theory, it suffices to describe the fields for which the fields from each conformal tower with just the lowest scaling dimension. And so if we have a finite, and these are called the primary fields. Now, if we have a finite number of primary fields, and these are what we're most interested in modeling, then we can expect to be able to reasonably represent a finite number of primary fields. We can take a finite number of sites on our lattice, which is only going to admit a basis of operators of finite dimension. But if we're careful about how we choose our coarse graining procedure, then we can make it so that the operators which are most the fields which are most faithfully represented on this space of operators, and it might be a space of 1-site operators, a space of 2-site operators, we can choose which particular space we want to work with, but the operators that are most faithfully represented on this finite space, the fields that are most faithfully represented on this finite space of operators, we can make it so that these correspond to the primary fields whose behavior is the most important to the conformal field theory. And then we get this scaling behavior for those operators. Now, an example of a lattice model, which behaves as a lattice representation of conformal field theory, is the quantizing model at criticality. Now, I've put up here the Hamiltonian for the quantizing model at criticality. We have a nearest neighbor coupling of sigma x nearest neighbor coupling with it, minus sigma x, and we have a magnetic field term. And when we simulate this, well, when we extract the local scaling operators that correspond to primary fields from this model, we find that we find 3 local scaling operators that correspond to primary fields, and these correspond to the primary fields customarily denoted I, sigma, and epsilon in the corresponding conformal field theory. But we also find that there's something we can call a non-local scaling operator. And so we get some additional fields from the conformal field theory, the disorder field and 2 fermion fields. But to understand how we get these, I have to introduce the notion of a non-local operator, a non-local scaling operator. And so where before we had an operator on a single site, and to either side on our infinite chain, we can think of it as having a half infinite string of identity operators on the sites to the right of it and to the sites to the left of it. Now this time, we have a particular operator on a site. It might be a sigma x operator, that's the blue blob. And then to the left here, we have a semi-infinite string of sigma z's. And to the right, we have a semi-infinite string of identity operators as before. Now again, we can apply our coarse-graining transformation. And on the coarse-grained lattice, if we're dealing with a non-local operator that is a non-local scaling operator, we find that again on the coarse-grained lattice, we've recovered exactly the same thing. We have a particular operator, sigma x, for example, on one site. And we have a semi-infinite string of sigma z's. And again, we may have multiplication by a constant, which is the scaling dimension of that of the corresponding conformal field. Okay, coarse graining. That is just this process where we have an original lattice with some number of sites, or we can work with an infinite lattice as we are in this case, and then we take that lattice, and then we apply some process which takes the number of sites, which takes the sites in this lattice, and gives us another. And gives us another lattice and reduces them to another lattice. The simplest sort of such procedure would just be a simple 3-into-1 contraction. What we're doing is we're taking three sites on the original lattice and we're replacing them with one site on what we call the coarse-grained lattice. Now, if these sites are, say, of dimension, well, let's just keep it simple and say dimension 2, then on the coarse-grained lattice, we also have our sites are also of dimension 2. Then what we're basically doing is we're performing. Then this is some sort of transformation that goes from a lattice with sites of dimension 2 to another lattice of sites of dimension 2. But for every three sites on the original lattice, we now only have one site on the coarse-grained lattice.
What's the actual projector? Is it a projector or what?
In this particular simple example, then yes, this would be some sort of a projector. And the way that, and actually determining the best, and what we tend to use is a slightly more complicated ansatz known as the multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz. But you're right, it is an important aspect of this that we have to determine what tensors to use. So here we have we're performing this contraction using a number of tensors here, and we optimize these tensors numerically there's a numerical optimization procedure which basically gives us the correct tensors for performing this coarse graining process so that okay.
The two states you're looking for satisfy the following problem.
Okay. For a critical model, we're interested in the lowest energy states, and so we keep the lowest energy subspace of the space on the original lattice. And for a critical model, this also happens to give us a coarse graining procedure, which reflects well the behavior of the primary fields of the conformal field theory. So that's the goal of our coarse graining procedure, to obtain the correct tensors. Sometimes, in principle, it may in some cases be possible to do it analytically, but we work with numerical approaches.
The string operator into the shorter one, or this is just, but this is all the case if we do this formulation? You mentioned that this string operator with the Jordan-Wigner transformation, right? And you mentioned that after this coarse graining, this is somehow effectively mapped to the same formula with some constant renormalized coupling, right? And is this just by chance, or this is?
I'll be mentioning a bit more about this later. In particular, semi-infinite strings of operators and how it's related to the Jordan-Wigner transformation.
basically, what we have is we have a course gradient procedure which corresponds to a particular conformal field theory. So we expect to have some representation of the primary fields on the lattice. Now, whether a particular representation is local or non-local, that's going to depend upon how we express our Hamiltonian, and that in turn is going to determine our course gradient procedure, and that in turn is going to determine whether a particular primary field is local or non-local in representation. But that's looking ahead slightly. So what we have is we have our Hamiltonian. Actually, I'm about to come on to some of that in a bit more detail now. We have our Hamiltonian specified in terms of spin variables, and we have some local scaling operators and some non-local scaling operators. But we can re-express that Hamiltonian in terms of fermionic variables using the Jordan-Vigner transformation. And so we're still working with the same physical system. The Hamiltonian is the same; it's just expressed in terms of fermionic variables now. It looks substantially different, but it is describing the same physical system. But what we find that's interesting about this is that once you perform this Jordan-Vigner transformation, the operators which are... We have a different set of operators which are local and which are non-local. So for the Jordan-Vigner transformed Hamiltonian, we find that the disorder operator, the fermion operators, the identity and epsilon are now the local operators, and only CMO, which was previously local, is now non-local. So what this is telling us is that there's nothing intrinsic about a particular conformal field which determines whether it's local or non-local in its representation. This depends very much upon how we upon how we express our Hamiltonian. So one last thing to do on the on our Ising model is to explain what I mean by a defect. So we can start with the quantum critical Ising model expressed in terms of spin variables, and we have that nearest neighbor coupling minus sigma x sigma x on adjacent sites. What we're going to do is we're going to take for one pair of sites 1 and 2, we're going to reverse the sign of that coupling, and so we do this by adding this extra term into the Hamiltonian, and this means that on sites 1 and 2 we now have plus sigma x, and everywhere else we have minus sigma x. Now, in doing this, we've broken translational invariance of the Hamiltonian. So previously the Hamiltonian was translation invariant, but now, now if we apply a translation, then we see that first term shifts from applying on sigma 1, sigma 2, applying on sites 1 and 2, to now apply on sites 2 and 3. So the system, if the system doesn't have translational invariance anymore, well, it no longer has the full symmetry group of the conformal field theory. But we can recover that. But we can recover the symmetry by slightly generalizing our notion of what we mean by translation. So instead of just simply So after we performed the usual translation on spin sites, what we do is we conjugate the resulting translated Hamiltonian with the sigma z operator on site 2. So here we have, so we apply sigma z on either side of the transformed Hamiltonian, and the effect of this is to change the sign of any sigma x coupling that acts on site 2. So on sites 2 and 3, we go from having plus sigma x to minus xx, and on sites 1 and 2, we go from having minus xx back to having plus xx. So we've moved the defect from sites 2 and 3 back to sites 1 and 2, where it originally was. So we have this generalized notion of translation, under which this new Hamiltonian with a defect is again invariant. And the particularly interesting thing about this Hamiltonian with the defect is that now we find that the operators which we've changed, this changes how we observe our operators. In fact, what we find is that the local scaling operators on this transformed Hamiltonian We find the same operators are local on the transformed Hamiltonian in spin variables as are local in the Hamiltonian expressed in terms of fermionic variables. So if we want to learn about if we want to study local operators on the Jordan-Bigner transformed Hamiltonian, we have two ways of doing it. We can study them directly, or we can study operators which are local in spin variables with a defect. So we actually have two approaches to studying the same system, and of course vice versa. We can study either one to learn about the other. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain the connection between what I've told you about anions and what I've told you about conformal field theory to a defect. So we're going to take a periodic lattice of n sites, and we're going to put a tau anion on each site. And this here is going to be our basis for our lattice of anions. So we have, again, as before, we have a number of variables there, x1 to xp. And we're going to have a two-site Hamiltonian term. So this is one term in the full Hamiltonian. What we're going to do is we're going to say it's a nearest neighbor interaction. And what we're going to say is if we fuse sites, in this case sites 4 and 5, and then we look at the total charge, we're going to apply a weighting to the state based upon that total charge. So we can favor fusing either into the 1 channel or into the tau channel. And if we favor fusing into the 1 channel, then we call this an antiferromagnetic interaction. And if we favor fusing into the tau channel, this is known as a ferromagnetic interaction.
What does fusing into the tau channel mean?
Okay, so back at the beginning, that's all right, no worries. I put up the fusion rules for Fibonacci anions, which I'll just quickly recap here, which basically describes how the different charges in the system interact. I also pointed out that fusing is not a destructive process. It can just correspond to, if you wanted to fuse two anions, it could just be a matter of measuring the total charge within an area that contains them both. So, what I mean by fusing favors the tau channel is that fusing a tau anion with another tau anion, we have two possible outcomes. They can fuse to either 1 or tau. And so, by specifying our Hamiltonian, we can favor one outcome or the other.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. Now, so what we're going to do is we're going to favor the combined charge of the anions on sites 4 and 5 being either 1 or tau, depending on whether we're looking at ferromagnetic or an antiferromagnetic coupling. Now, and of course we can define a total Hamiltonian just by applying the same process to all pairs of sites. And we're going to identify site n plus 1 is the same as site 1 in the expression for Hamiltonian. In other words, exactly what you'd expect for a periodic system. We have h1, 2, h2, 3, up to hn minus 1, hn, and then we have hn1. Now, how do we study a system like this? One method which has been proposed by Fagurian et al. In 2007 is that you'll notice the degrees of freedom for our basis of anionic states, all are on this line indicated in red here. Now, each of these degrees of freedom can correspond to either a charge of 1 or a charge of tau. And so what we can do is we can map this into a spin chain where we identify, say, spin up with 1 and spin down with tau. And then we restrict the Hilbert space of that spin chain so as to give us only, so as to admit only states that correspond to valid fusion trees for our Fibonacci anions.
Sorry, I don't understand this picture. The upper line is the spin chain, right? The horizontal line will be the spin chain.
That's right, yes.
So what's the meaning of the red line? How can you uniquely get the red line from? Because this fusion, you show the order, right? If you fuse first one on top one, then the outcome on top two, etc. So what does this mean? But a priori, whenever I fuse two, I have two choices. So
yes, but for a particular
single picture, is the antiferromagnetic or the ferromagnetic state?
It's a bit more general than that. What it is that we have this basis which is specified by the fusion tree, and that gives us a basis. But if I just do one with, say, let's put phi one here, 5 tau anions. And the first two, we could, we'll fuse. Okay, actually, I'll make this more on the overheads, and I'll start from the vacuum, and I'll fuse the taus in one at a time. So this one's necessarily a tau. Now, this one's necessarily a tau. And then we have two here that could be either one or tau. Now, a particular individual state will be some choice here. So it might be so that will be one particular state. And that state would correspond to having, on the spin chain, you'd have a one, you have spin up on one side and a spin down on the other, correspond, on the free sides, correspond to that one being in state one and that one being in state two.
It shows the way, an order of fusing, and then you express in terms of the total spin according to one particular order of fusing.
Exactly. And so our mapping to the spin chain we've chosen a particular fusion tree, and our mapping corresponds to that particular fusion tree. And that is actually important, an important aspect of this, in that we are now bound to this fusion tree if we start simulating things using the spin chain. We based our spin chain on the assumption that this tree is how we're describing our system of anions. But now, the next thing to note is that our two-site Hamiltonian on two sites on the lattice of anions, it turns out it's a non-trivial result, but it turns out that we can express this this Hamiltonian on two sites of the anionic lattice as a three-site operator on the spin chain. And we can identify the three sites that this operator acts on are identified in the lower diagram there. So this is a nice property of the mapping. Now I'm going to change the way I've drawn this slightly, just for convenience, in that I'm no longer going to actually put all the tiles at the top there, but so that we can distinguish the tiles from the one inside. An open solid line corresponds to one with a tau at the end, and a dashed open line is the line in the vacuum state. And I just pulled this one out of the way slightly here. It's not actually changing my representation at all. I've just moved that out of the way, so it's not going to interfere with our diagram in a minute. Now, I showed you how we can represent the the Hamiltonian term on sites 4 and 5. Similarly, you can take the Hamiltonian term on sites 3 and 4, and we can turn that into a three-site operator on sites 1, 2, and 3 on the spin chain. We can do it for sites 2 and 3, 1 and 2. And then we get to the end, and now we want to work out how to represent the two-site Hamiltonian term that acts on sites n and 1. So the term that we have by virtue of working with periodic boundary conditions. So how are we going to represent this term? To actually understand this, we have to look a bit more closely at what we mean by periodic translation, by translation for a periodic chain of anions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at a translation where we take each site and we translate it along by one, so a periodic translation. Now, to perform any manipulation on a system of anions, we're restricted to using only the manipulations that I gave us at the beginning. We can have fusion and splitting, we can have F moves, and we can have grading, which is governed by the R matrix. We can't perform any other operations, so we have to use the grading rule to describe what we're doing. And what I'm going to do is say that, I'm going to show first of all how we perform a periodic translation on a state. And what we do is we take the site at the end, and we're going to grade it consecutively with all of the other sites. So it goes from the far right-hand end to the far left-hand end. And you'll notice that in this case I've graded over the top of the other sites. We have freedom to choose whether we've graded over the top or underneath. This corresponds to whether we close our periodic chain towards us or away from us. But once we've made that choice, we have to be consistent in it. Excuse me. So that's how we look at a translation on states. Now, to perform a translation on an operator, And we'll start with our operator that's on lattice sites 4 and 5, corresponds to spin chain sites x2, x3, x4 again. To translate an operator, we act on this with the translation operator via the adjoint action. So basically we act on it from both sides, like this. And you'll notice that the line that we take from the far right hand end and we bring it over to the left, and then we take it back to the right again, it doesn't interact with anything else. It doesn't twist around any other lines, and it doesn't connect to the operator. And a very useful feature of this diagrammatic representation for states of anions is that we can take this diagram, or any diagram indeed, and we can deform it in any way that preserves the topology of the diagram, and it will still be a representation of the same state. Now, there is one further requirement, which is that our operator here is charge conserving. It doesn't change the charge of the system it's acting on. This is what's called a symmetric operator, and they're the natural objects to expect in a model of anions. Our Hamiltonian operator, our two-side operator that I've described, the ferromagnetic or the antiferromagnetic coupling, this satisfies that property. And so we can take that loop and we can push it all the way across to the right and get this diagram here. And so now you see that our Hamiltonian is no longer acting on the fourth and fifth sites of the anionic lattice, it's now acting on the third and the fourth sites of the anionic lattice. And this corresponds to an operator on x1, x2, and x3 of the spin chain. So this is exactly what we want translation to do. It's basically moved both the anion and it brings both the anionic Hamiltonian term and the equivalent spin Hamiltonian term along by one.
Can you show again the two pictures?
Oh, certainly, yes. So here we go. We're applying the translation operator in the adjoint action. And now we're going to push that top loop over to the right.
Yeah. So it continues to act on sites 1. It is already acting on sites 3 and 4.
So it starts off on sites 4 and 5. But then when we apply the translation operator, that's what connects it to sites 3 and 4. And then all we're doing here is a simplification of our diagram, which allows us to realize that actually we have a simple operation. It's again just a two-site operation. And I could highlight it, but yeah, this now acts on sites 1, 2, and 3 of the spin chain as desired. But now that we know how to perform translation on a system of anions, we can do it right over here at the far end as well. And so again, we apply the translation operation. But this time, we can't simplify the diagram in the same way as we did before. The line that comes over from the end now interacts with the Hamiltonian, so we can't detach that and push it over to the end and obtain a simple and we can't obtain something that looks as simple a diagram as previously in this particular choice of basis. Notice what happens when it's still a two-site operator on anions, because this operator here is still connected just to this anion site here and this anion site here. But the diagram is less neat, and this has implications for when we map it to a spin chain.
I don't understand. I'm sorry, I'm a bit lost here with these lines. This line is not interacting with the other lines, right? It is just a picture.
That's right, it's just a depiction. But
what's special about 1 and then we compare it to 2 and 3? I don't see it.
The difference is, when we're working on an operator like this, we can map it to the spin chain simply by looking at where it sits on this basis and identifying the three sites which are adjacent to it, and it acts on those three sites on this, well, the three variables here, or in this case two of them fixed, and it acts on those on the spin chain. But when we're looking at this operator, we can no longer simply identify three adjacent elements of the basis, which is axon.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it looks like it needs to know all the history of fusion to know what is the last there.
Exactly. And so this is going to cause us to have something different happen on the spin chain. But let's note what happens if we apply translation again. So we apply our translation operation one more time, and now you'll see that you can take the entire two-site term of the Hamiltonian and push that term all the way to the right-hand end. Now, once we get there, we have a complete twist above and below the Hamiltonian. We take two sets and we twist them, we play them around each other in a complete rotation. And we have the same in the opposite direction below that Hamiltonian. But a complete vein like this. I guess I should probably draw this up on the blackboard, actually, just to help make clear what I'm talking about.
Just that I'm told it.
You can, but only because that operator is charge conserving. And the reason for that is because when you have something like this, then that basically amounts to a phase. And what we have down beneath a charge, this applies a charge dependent phase for the state. So the phase is dependent on the charge of those two sites fused together. Now, because this operator is, and so we have a wave in one direction which applies some phase, and a wave in the other direction which applies some phase, and provided this operator in the middle conserves charge, then these two phases are going to be identical, they're going to be conjugate to each other, and they're going to cancel out. And so once again, we can push the operator all the way to the other end, and this time we can also untwist it, and again we get something nice and compact. We can take this operator, and we can say it's two sites on the anionic lattice, and it's three sites on the spin chain, which we see in the before. So, going back to where I left this, we now know how to perform a translation of this operator on the... We now know how to represent this end term on the anionic system, but to represent it on the spin chain is a bit more complicated. So, in fact, this is going to be a very large diagram, which is going to fly past now, and then I'll point out some key features, and I'll shrink it down so you can see the whole thing. So here it comes. And the important features are, we have a string of operators which are labeled B. They start at one end of the spin chain, and they come all the way, and we apply them all the way along the spin chain, shifting by one side each time. And the B operator corresponds to performing a draining of a pair of anions on the anionic basis. And then we apply our Hamiltonian term, which is the usual three-side Hamiltonian term that it's the same as we've been using all along. And then we apply the conjugate of the B operator all the way back again.
So does that correspond to just moving one all the way over here, you do what you need to do, and then you move back, just like in the diagram?
Exactly, just like in the diagram. But the point is that to do this, we no longer have a nice, neat, simple three-site operator. We've got something bigger. So this is just the whole thing in a zoomed-out view. You can see it all at once. Now, so that's what that odd term looks like on spins. And then when we translate it again, we get back to a nice, compact three-site term again. So this is a defect. It's directly analogous to the system I described with the Ising model, where we have one form of a Hamiltonian. In the Ising model, it's the Jordan-Bigler transform Hamiltonian, where all the terms basically look the same, and we can apply the natural definition of translation. The corresponding thing is on the anions, all the terms look the same on the fusion tree basis. We have just a two-site term that always looks the same. And we use the natural definition of translation for anions, which is the Bayesian process that I drew for you. And these systems, these correspond to, we can also model the same system using a transformed Hamiltonian, which has with a defect. So for the Jordan-Bigler Hamiltonian here, we have a Hamiltonian on spin chains with a defect and with a modified notion of translation. And those simulate the same system. Similarly with anions, from our system of anions on a fusion tree, We've mapped our model on a spin chain, but we also have one term in Hamiltonian which looks decidedly different to all the others, and we have a modified notion of translation. It's not standard translation on a spin chain. It's applying this sequence of the string of blade operators. And it just happens in most cases. Under this modified notion of translation, which is the application of this blading process represented on the spin chain, this new Hamiltonian with the defect is again invariant. So it's a directly analogous situation. We have a defect on the spin chain to model a system without the defect on the harmonic matrix. Now, previous authors, this Beguin et al. Again, have used this mapping to the spin chain to relate the antiferromagnetic and ferromagnetic nearest to relate systems of anions interacting with antiferromagnetic or ferromagnetic coupling to particular conformal field theories. Their critical models and their scale these are quantum critical models, but what they explored were systems which were translationally invariant on the spin chains. They had the spin chain's natural definition of translations. This enabled them to identify the underlying conformal field theory, and so it gives us some substantial insight into the underlying mathematical structure of the model, but it doesn't describe how a physical system of anions on a lattice to which we apply a Hamiltonian which is translationally invariant on those anions will behave. And so if we get to the point where we can, create a system of anions with a translationally invariant Hamiltonian, then to actually understand how the system behaves, we have to model this on a spin chain using a Hamiltonian and notion of translation with a defect. And this significantly changes the experimental predictions which you get. So just to illustrate this, this is the energy spectrum of the antiferromagnetic Hamiltonian on 26 spin degrees of freedom and on 26 anions. I've shifted these energy spectra so that they start at zero, and I've rescaled them according to a relationship between the energy spectrum and the scaling dimensions of conformal field theory, but that's not particularly important. What we can see from this is that there is a distinct qualitative difference between these spectra. Look, for example, at the first four energy levels on each side. If we take a system that's translationally invariant under the usual notion of translation on spins, then we find that the distance between the third and the fourth energy levels is substantially larger than any of the preceding gaps, or any of the preceding distances at the energy level. Whereas if we look at a system on anions, so we have the defect included, then the interval between the third and the fourth energy levels is much smaller than between the second and the third, or the first and the second. So a real qualitative difference in what will be observed in experiment, and so the take-home message is that to understand the behavior in an actual physical system of anions, you can understand this by mapping them to a spin chain, and modeling the behavior of the spin chain. But you have to be very careful about how you handle translation. And to understand that physical system of anions, you have to include, you will in general acquire a defect in the model on the spin chain. So that's the end of the talk. Do we have any questions?
It's just a question. Very basic question. Can I think of this defect as if I just have hopping between nearest neighbors, the spin is just moving, and then I want, when it moves between spin, say n and 1, I want to give it some phase, and this would be like the phase of the particle not being 1 or minus 1 with that or something else. Can I interpret needing a defect in this way?
For this particular defect, we have not been able to identify a simple local transformation of that nature for this particular defect. For some models, such as for the influencing model with the with the defect that I described, then yes, you just have it's equivalent to anti-periodic boundary conditions. But we're not aware of an equivalence, of a similar equivalence for this particular model. The simplest description we have so far is the one that I've given today.
What are the conformational theories which arise?
For the anti-ferromagnetic coupling, it's the attractive polarizing model. And for the ferromagnetic coupling, it's the three-state chiral Potts model. So M54 and 65.
So how much of this actually depends on Fibonacci anyways?
Well,
is that just a device, a plot device?
To some extent, yes, in that it's important that we actually have, we felt it was important that we actually have some system that we have applied this to, and we have a demonstrable real change in behavior, and that it's important for, and that this system is physically relevant. But in general, for any system of anions, we can expect a similar behavior. You have a notion of translation on the anions, and you have a notion of translation on the spins, and these will not, in general, coincide. So the choice of Fibonacci anions was to give you something concrete rather than trying to deal with a notion of a generalized anion model, which would have made the talk probably twice as involved.
Well, if I can just inquire, though, about what some of the complexities are that arise. I mean, if you have more than one fusion channel, so you might also argue that another rod would picture the icing anions, for example, new equals 5 halves, and so on.
Yeah.
There you have three types of anions.
Yeah.
And do you need? How does the analysis carry through when you have more than one type of anion?
Okay. So first of all, you actually have to specify what kind of model you wanted to look at. Here we had
single-state icing.
Yeah, and also, so you have to specify the anions, and you have to have some sort of initial condition, like maybe you want to populate your chain with spin a half anions, and then you have to have some sort of Hamiltonian, whether you want to, what particular fusion outcome you want to favor, half and half fusing to zero or to one, because that's the same. If this is SU2 level two, the new classified half model. And so once you've done that, you can work through the same thing. You specify a particular Hamiltonian, you specify the system that you're looking at, which might be a chain filled with spin a half anions, and then you have exactly the same process. You have your Hamiltonian defined on you have a term defined on two adjacent anions. You can translate that along. When you get to the boundary again, to perform the translation at the boundary, you have to debate the ansatz over. So for an analogous physical, for an analogous Hamiltonian, and an analogous physical system, so a chain of a particular type of anions, it carries through exactly the same process.
And you still only get sort of one defect term that you have to consider.
Absolutely. And that comes from...
But that defect term would be different if you had... it depends on the initial conditions. Right? If I had chosen for icing anions, I could put a string of... you've chosen one tau, 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 tau. But well, the icing anions, yeah. There are many more choices.
The one isn't possible.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah. But with icing anions, there's lots of different choices.
Absolutely.
The defect that you get out depends on.
The defect.
Okay, but you don't get multiple defect terms that you have to keep track of.
No, the nice thing is that because you can write this, because you can always choose some fusion tree like this, you can write your Hamiltonian, assuming that you can write your Hamiltonian as a two-site local Hamiltonian on the anionic lattice, then you'll be able to map that. Then you'll be able to map that into a three-site term on the spin chain, but anywhere where you can simply write it above this initial choice of fusion tree, which you base the spin chain on. So the simple fact that we can take this and we can write a Hamiltonian term for the Hamiltonian there, and then we don't need to understand translation to write the same Hamiltonian on these two sites and the equivalent mapping. And so that shows us that we don't really need to understand the translation process, and it doesn't do anything weird. anything complicated until we reach this term at the end. And so we always have exactly one defect.
Just a conceptual question. Are you trying to model translational invariance by a non-translationally invariant physical system? And is that what you're doing?
Well, we slightly modify. We have a system that, under the original definition of translation, is not invariant.
Yes.
But under the new definition, is.
Yeah, well, it's like you're simulating these anyons, right? Are you using
it
effectively? Okay. So that was one thing. Then the other thing is, on the last slide, you said that the energy levels were different. So does that mean that if you took the spin chain and you just glued end to end, then you would get radically you get different behavior than on the simulated system?
That's exactly what I'm saying in that with that end result slide.
Okay, so then my final question is, have you thought about this because you can do CFT on this, right? Conformal field theory, you said. So have you thought about trying to do ADS CFT simulations with this and maybe have some emergent gravity? I'm not kidding, actually.
We haven't looked at that yet.
Okay.
That would be something
we should do that.
That would be really interesting. I don't know. That would be really interesting to look into. I agree. Regarding defects, by the way, in essence, all what we can say is that we're only forced to have one defect. In fact, really, in this mapping, we only get one defect. For more general systems, you can study systems with multiple defects, and you can study how defects interact. But in this case, you have just one. When we're studying a translation invariant system on anions.
Is there any other questions?
We have plenty to do studying anions, but I like the idea.
Okay, then let's thank speaker once again.